All right, Nick, what are we doing for the cold open? Come on, like, seriously, let's get it going. Don't stutter on me now. Don't stutter on me now. Come on, spit it out.
It's been a month. You got 3 minutes.
Oh, God. I have notes in my phone.
3 minutes. It's ticking down. You big sausage, make those Jimmy Deans dance. Come on, like, figure out what little notes you have on the phone. Come on, 3 minutes.
Come
what
on,
you
Nick,
got?
3 minutes and we're out of here.
A Thunder in Paradise cheeseburger in Paradise cover.
I don't like it already. Move on. I don't like it. To next one. Next one down.
I don't know what this note means, but it says hiding someone's baby.
Hate it already. You use the word notes. Notes are very overdone these days. Don't like it. Move on to the next one.
DJ Vanilla Sex.
I told you we only have 3 minutes. Don't waste my time, okay?
With age, we all go from too sweet to too old.
I mean, you do realize I could be having sex with my girlfriend in these 3 minutes, and you're bringing me this bullshit? Like, I mean, I could be from close off to climax. I could have already had sex with my girlfriend this amount of time, and this is what you present to me?
You had an extra 2 minutes and 45 seconds, Nick.
Yeah, and you came up with that, and this is what you did.
We'll just start the show, I guess. Hello, and welcome to 10 Bell Pod. I am Nick Alexander, joined by Tyler Wood.
Is that it? Well, hey, I guess.
I love it. Keep doing that. Keep introducing him that way.
We are joined by a member of the Iowahi family. Iowahi family. The Man Scout Jake Manning.
Is that racist? I don't know. There was a second there, and then it sounded like a Native American tribe.
I thought it was Native American for a second.
I thought we were going there, and then I realized it was a pun. And then I was like, ooh, it's equally as bad. What can I say? I appreciate the effort, Nicholas.
Look, I don't know what this is. Like episode 90? I've done 90 of these. It's getting increasingly more impossible. So today, we are discussing tag team wrestling specialist, superhero, and the brother of Roman Reigns, Rosie. So I feel like this is going to be another Tyler episode, but Jake, Tyler, what do you know about Rosie?
My first memory of Rosie was his superhero in training gimmick. I do not remember seeing him as a part of 3 Minute Warning. I've gone back and I've watched some stuff, but I fell in love with Rosie during his run with the Hurricane, which was, in retrospect, way too short. But he brought me a lot of joy through that. And, like, seeing the comedic side first and then going back later, I have an appreciation for how he's able to switch from that, like, Samoan monster who's nearly 400 pounds. I listened to Jim Ross say that about 15 times. switch from that to this, you know, fun-loving kid character and kind of just went from there, and I'm happy I got to enjoy a little bit of that as a kid, and we can go back over it here.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed the stuff that he did. Like, it's a good body of work. It's a fun body of work. It's got its own place, and it's memorable. I know, like, the Hurricane, every once in a while, he'll put out something about Rosie or see some picture about it and make some comment about how wonderful and nice he is. And the few times that I've met him, he's been very cordial. Even though he produced one of the worst shoot interviews that was ever released by High Spots, to the point that I was told to not even waste my time editing it, just put the one camera angle out, hit a start point and end point, and just release it. It was funny. He was recording it after a show, and it was a long night, and he had a full day of travel, and then he's doing the shoot. And I gotta say, I appreciate the honesty that when he started the interview, he was like, look, I don't feel like doing this, but I need the money. I'll answer every question you want. I'll tell every story you want, but I'm not feeling it. And you know what? I'd rather have somebody do that than bite your head off while you're on camera. Like, I preferred the honesty, the straightforwardness, directness. If anything, like, it made me appreciate him more when I really should have been like, dude, you're wasting my time. I don't want to be here either, but I too have a job as well. So yeah, very straightforward, no bullshit guy, and you could definitely get that impression from his High Spot shooter interview. But hopefully we'll delve deep into the softer side, the better side, the highlights, more so of Rosie's career as opposed to what High Spots produced many years ago or produced in extra quotation marks.
Matthew Anawai was born April 7th, 1970 in San Francisco, California. Matt is obviously part of the legendary Anawai wrestling family, aka the Bloodline, the family that has produced The Rock, Yokozuna, Rikishi, the Wild Samoans, Usos, Umaga, Roman Reigns, just to name a few. Matt was the son of Sika, an older brother of Roman Reigns, and as a drinker of The Rock's energy drink, Zoa Energy, I also feel like the Anawai spirit runs through my veins.
I could tell. we all can tell. You've been doing a lot of push-ups, and it's very noticeable. I thoroughly await for your tribal tattoo across your pec, which are well-defined now because of that Anawahi blood that flows through your veins.
Is this what the pre-show chant was about, Nick? When you got on and started doing the
football team does it. Shit. This is, of course,
the All Blacks, right?
I don't know.
It's the New Zealand All Blacks. I hope to God it is.
that Eastern Carolina is coming out of you real thick, like Tyler.
It is the All Blacks. I'm not racist.
Okay. Yeah, I know. Right. I know you're not. I know what you're talking about. But yes, because they dress in all black, not because of their skin color, as Tyler will lead you to believe.
All right, moving on.
While Matt was obviously surrounded by the business and grew up with a full-sized ring in his backyard, his first love was football. And while we wrestling fans associate Samoans with wrestling, the main sport that has made its way into the culture is football, at least in American Samoa. According to a 60 Minutes report, Samoans are 56 times more likely to make it to the NFL than the average American. That's insane.
Factual. I 100% believe that because every Samoan I've ever met has been a guy you wouldn't want to mess with. I have never met a guy that is Samoan that I wouldn't be like, ooh, don't want to mess with this guy. I want to be friends with him.
So being a wrestler's kid, the family moved around a good bit, but Matt landed in Pensacola, Florida for his high school years. And of course, the 6'7", 300-pounder blue chipper played football there. And kind of like how I played AAU against Steph Curry or Jake Russell-Tent, Matt dominated the line at Escambia High School, where he was teammates with Emmitt Smith. Tyler, three guesses. Who did Emmitt Smith play for?
Emmitt Smith.
Oh, my God.
The Cowboys. The Cowboys?
Oh, there you go. All right. Oh, there you go.
It is. I had to go through my files. That's all.
I love how you had to go through your files, and I automatically knew it. Now, granted, I was a kid in the 90s, so I was a fan of the Cowboys. So, yeah, just further proof that Emmitt Smith was propped up by a good offensive line, not only in the pros, but also in high school as well.
Matt went on to play offensive line for Hawaii University, but he ended up not making the NFL. Once football didn't work out, Rosie got a job as a floor manager at a strip club in New Orleans. That's probably worse jobs. But he had a moment where he realized that he didn't want to be 60 years old working in a strip club in New Orleans. So around 24 years old in 1994, he decided it was time to join the family business.
Hold up. Let's take a little step. You went through stuff so fast. He went to college, played collegiate football at Hawaii, football star at Hawaii, and then he worked in a strip club in his 20s. That's a life that I always dreamed of. Now he's going to get into wrestling, and he has somebody who could open a door for him? Charmed life old Matthew has had so far in his 20 years. I'm very jealous. He was not a young Jake Manning who was driving an S10 pickup truck that his father gifted him, but also then told him, well, it's stick shift. You got to learn how to drive it if you want this car. So here you go. And then sifting through the change in the cup holder to pay for McDonald's on the way home after an indie show that I got $20 for. So old Matthew has lived a very nice life so far. Good on him.
Matt always wanted to make it clear that wrestling wasn't like a last resort or anything. He said whether he played a year in the NFL or 15 years in the NFL, wrestling was always going to come into his life at some point. Once Matt decided to get into the business, his dad Sika moved a ring down to New Orleans for a few months to start training him, getting him into wrestling shape. And then he headed to Allentown, where he trained at the Wild Samoan School. And I say train, but he literally grew up in the business, literally having a ring in his backyard, and he just had a private camp with Sika. So his time training was more like hitting the indies, getting reps in, learning how to work in front of an audience, and just polishing up what he knew.
Well, and also probably helps, you know, he would have saw wrestling his entire life. And much in the same sense that anybody who's a fan or a super fan that finally gets into wrestling and has athletic ability, it transfers very easily because as a fan, you're like, you see somebody do a hip toss, the announcer calls it a hip toss, and you look at it and you appreciate it. And then you get somebody in the ring with you and they know how to do a hip toss and they show you how to give and take said hip toss. But you've already, in your mind, seen a hip toss over and over and over again. And if you're an athlete, you know, you have gone to camps or took instructions for a coach where they're like, hey, when you do something, move your body like this. Or when you lift, do this. Or when you push this guy, move your foot here or keep your balance here. You already have those skills of learning how to move your body, and then you have all these years of seeing wrestling and knowing what everything is already. You just need to be taught how to do it, and you have this athletic ability, so it all just kind of comes together really fast. I mean, that's what it was for me. Like, doing the moves wasn't a problem. Learning the importance of listening to the people was what I had to learn, where athletically you could show me in an afternoon how to do a series of moves, except for any types of flips. That my body is not capable of that whatsoever. But the basics, the regular moves and the moves that he would do, he could probably learn an entire afternoon because he has years of data seeing it and then years of data learning how to operate his body through coaching.
Matt started working in his Uncle Afa's World Extreme Wrestling in 95. By November 95, he also went to Puerto Rico and got his first international experience in WWC. By December 95, Matt started using the name Mac Daddy Kane and tagged up with his older cousin Samu to form the Samoan Gangster Party.
And they were all over the Northern Indies. I remember them showing up on VHS tapes that I would find over the years, and you could find Samoan gangsters pop up a lot. And that's always the interesting thing about the Samoan family. You would have uncles that were a little bit older and nephews. There was always like one Samoan that was older, and then somebody got in the business, and then they became a tag team. And then they wrestled everywhere and traveling to shows. So you have somebody right there with you in your matches, and you're learning through them, basically through these matches on the job training. And then it just so happens then a cousin gets involved, and then the older one starts to retire, and then now all of a sudden the young one is now the old one in the group. And it always seems to work out that way, that there's always one in, and then they make a tag team, and then the older one goes out, and then the young one becomes the older one, and a cousin comes in. Like, you've seen it over the years with the Samoans, and it's just family knowledge being passed through to family knowledge, and using a tag team as a bridge through the years.
Samoan Gangster Party also had this like really short-lived WWE run that was about a month of house shows and like two TVs, but apparently Samu and Vince like hated each other, so that was the end of that.
Vince hated a Samoan? I doubt that. I he loves him so much and lets him get away with so much. Like, what did Samu do? Like, that's what I want to know. That got Vince, who's like the most googly-eyed in love with the Samoan, just like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. I'm just so starstruck by these Samoans. I have to have them on my TV at all moments in time.
In 96, there is a bit of a gap where I assume they were mostly working like small shows before the Samoan Gangsters went to ECW, June of 96. They made their in-ring debut at 96's Hardcore Heaven against Axel Rotten and Hack Myers in a match that is not much longer than the entrances. The ECW crowd chants Yokozuna the whole time.
Lovely.
You see, the thing with Smarks is that they know about wrestling, and by letting you know that they know about wrestling, it lets you know that they're just as cool as the wrestlers who are wrestling. So sorry, Jake, you picked the wrong side.
Was that them trying to tell them, like, hey, we know you're related? Or was that just them being racist and being like, that's the only Samoan we know?
Probably, maybe, I don't know, making that declaration, that seems about right. And of course, just typical Paul Heyman, trying to find a way to make some money off of Samoans. Just find a way to weasel his way in.
So the Samoan gangsters, I'm going to say gangsters because I can't pull off gangsters. The Samoan Gangsters hit a double headbutt from the second rope on Hack, which was going to win the match, but the not-Samoan Gangsters knew Jack and Mustafa run in because the Samoan Gangsters had interfered in their tag title match previously against the Eliminators, And then this ends in like a good old locker room clearing bra, no contest. So in ECW, it didn't seem like they were like full time or anything. It looks like they were getting booked a couple weekends a month from June to October, mostly facing New Jack and Mustafa.
Yeah, they were on a lot of the house shows, and you can see a lot of the fan cam matches that are on them. I think there's like a couple of like kind of sleeper really good matches on some of those like shows, and they would be in like Jim Thorpe and that building that was about ready to fall off the mountain. I think they were at a couple of those shows, maybe some of the Harrisburg shows, maybe even an Allentown, Pennsylvania show is in my mind. But I remember seeing those matches come up on some of the listings when I was converting the video footage.
Following ECW, it was a bunch of smaller gigs, but taking on some cool names like Duke Drosy, the Headbangers, and the Rock and Roll Express in Charlotte. Back in WXW in 97, Matt won the tag titles a couple of times with his cousin Lloyd, who worked as LA Smooth. They also made a trip back to Puerto Rico to grab their titles. In 98, Matt worked as Matty Smalls and worked a bunch of matches with Snuka. But by 99, Matt would start wrestling in Japan, working for FMW, and here is where his career really starts taking off. He worked with yet another cousin, Eddie Fatu, who you may know as Umaga. They worked as Armageddon, with Ed as Armageddon 1 and Matt as Armageddon 2, debuting March 20th, 99 during FMW's Round Robin Tag League, also teaming up with Ricky Fuji. As part of FMW's Brass Knuckles Tag Team Tournament, they faced Hayabusa and his partner Kodo Fuyuki. Always have to shout out Hayabusa when he pops up. They took mostly losses in the tournament.
I mostly remember them seeing them in the magazines for the Heartland stuff, but I remember their kind of, I might have seen a couple pictures or it being discussed in the magazines. Like, this just shows how old I am. I sound like a 70-year-old man, like, oh, you know, when I was reading the magazines back in the day. But yeah, I remember them popping up a lot in the magazines, obviously, because the people writing the magazines were writing stories about Afa and Sika back in the day. And like, oh, well, here's the next version of the Wild Samoans, but a more updated version, and guys that could really fly around and not only like brawl with you and headbutt you and chop you and slam you around, but guys that could do, you know, leg lariats and spin heel kicks like these guys could do. But yeah, like they were kind of much more an updated version of the Wild Samoans. This is kind of where it all kind of forms in Japan. That's one of the things too, like it was FMW, there was obviously tape trading, there was obviously, I think FMW was even on DirecTV for a while, and you could order the pay-per-views as well too, but really the mainstream wrestling audience would not know about you, where I feel like now everybody knows everything between streaming and Twitter, and if you do anything of interesting of note, like people will put it on a Twitter timeline and they'll see it over and over again, whether they've seen the entire match or not, where, you know, you can kind of still be a little invisible. Like, people can be aware that you're over there and you're doing things and things are going good, but, you know, you're not getting as much exposure as you do now, which might be kind of even overexposure now. So, which is good, because then when you're actually up here and a mainstream promotion, it's like new and fresh and we want to know more about you, as opposed to we already know a lot about you. Okay, you're here now. Great, we're happy for you. Okay, go back in the used toy pile.
In May of 2000, they dropped the Armageddon shtick, I assume because we didn't all die in Y2K, and they started working as the Samoans. Matt was Matt Samu, Ed Eddie Fatu, and then June 21st, 2000, the Samoans beat Hosanna and Sasaki to win the FMW Hardcore Tag Titles. The two would hold on to the titles for about a month, make two successful title defenses before dropping them right back off to Sasaki and Hosaka July 28th. So he's already like quite the tag team title collector this early in his career.
And you said it was the Hardcore Tag Team Titles. Jake, true or false, if a Samoan uses a headbutt in a match, is it a foreign object because they have a harder skull than everybody else?
Are you trying to bait me into a very racist conversation?
No, not really. I got partway through. I said foreign object and realized I didn't want to say foreign object. I meant.
Oh, you did. No, you did. Don't worry. I didn't mean to. Don't worry. I'm still regretting saying googly eyed earlier. I don't know if that's like, I meant the more like loving eyes when I said that earlier, but I was like, ooh, I don't know if that's a racist term as well. No, I'm not going to go there, but I did have a wrestling trainer explain to me one point in time, you can't punch a Samoan or a black man in the head unless you sell your hand, because their head is harder than everybody else's. That is something that was taught to me in wrestling school. Also, too, the real dilemma of if you have a Samoan headbutting somebody like Junkyard Dog, who sells it? Because whose head is harder? And the answer is Junkyard Dog's head is harder than a Samoan's. So, and he gleefully explained that to me as if that was the greatest thing ever. I will not name names, but that is a conversation that happened in my reality.
That was day one, like before any bumps, orientation, anything. It's like, all right, first thing you need to know.
First thing you need to know is this.
The next jump for the Samoans would be to WWE Developmental in early 2001. So no NXT or FCW these days. They started out in Memphis Championship Wrestling and also added some Heartland Wrestling Association.
Yeah, Memphis territory, which I believe also had Brian Kendrick, American Dragon, Tracy Smothers was also one of the trainers. Kay Quick, Ron Killings was there as well, too. William Regal did a stint there. Reckless Youth. I mean, really forgotten about developmental territory and just kind of never got off the ground the way they wanted to. I think mostly because I think Randy Hales was involved and he was like, it was just like, oh, let's send him there to learn how to work. And then like, what carny wonderland did we drop these people off at? And they're like, maybe this isn't the best thing for them to be learning. And then obviously Heartland Wrestling involved with Les Thatcher, who is a wonderful, wonderful teacher. Maybe some of the things that he discussed isn't as up to date now, but as far as the basics and the importance of learning the psychology of professional wrestling and the history of professional wrestling, which is what you really need to know in the first 2 or 3 years, maybe not at year 10 or 12, but definitely in those early years, you need to understand and get the appreciation of what he's describing and talking about. So that's a lot of what's going on there. So yeah, it was really weird that you had these somewhat successful indie promotions and then WWE would just tap them on the shoulder and be like, you are now a developmental program and here are future Hall of Famers that will be training with you and available in all of your shows. Congratulations, hopefully they turn out well.
The boys would get a rebranding with Matt changing to Chemo and Ed changing to ECMO, becoming the Island Boys with a Z, because you a bitch if you make words plural with an S. More of a written joke, but whatever.
And this is not to be confused with the new rap group, the Island Boys, correct?
Yeah, you know what? I barely know who that is.
Unfortunately, they keep coming up in my timeline.
Obviously, you have two big badass motherfuckers with a good bit of experience. They have ties to the Federation. So they start flying through developmental and then get some dark matches on Jacked pretty quickly.
Good old Jacked and Velocity leading the way in WWE syndicated programming. Proto AEW Dark, as I'd like to call it. But yeah, I was so jealous of anybody that got to see Jacked and Metal and all of those like syndicated programs. I mean, I used to stay up late. This is before like DVRs were a thing. I would stay up late because we had a New York affiliate on DirecTV, like a local station that carried Wrestling Challenge, which was pretty much a clip show, but there'd be like one original match on it, and I would stay up late just to watch it on Saturday nights just so I could see this one match that wasn't on Raw or any of the other programming that was available. But it was just a syndicated show that was just, you would get some really interesting highlight videos and some promos that were in longer form, like the Jerry the King Lawler Kiss My Foot match. Like, there was some really great promos on that about that particular match that you wouldn't see on Raw because they'd be like 2 or 3 minutes long, but there was these really nice vignettes on there. But Jacked, Metal, Velocity, all of that. Those would have been my jam.
The Island Boys won the HWA tag titles November 14th, 2001, beating Evan Karagias, I think, and Shannon Moore. I know Shannon Moore. The Island Boys would trade them back and forth with Steve Bratley and Val Venus, who recently said he was going to quit wrestling, to which everyone replied, no one fucking cares, Val Venus, quit. No one gives a shit. July 22nd, 2002, Matt, now named Rosie, and Eddie, now named Jamal, made their big boy debut on Raw as 3-Minute Warning. 3-minute warning, basically hired enforcers of Raw GM Eric Bischoff. He'd give people 3 minutes to entertain him, and if they didn't, he'd send the big guys out to beat that ass. Probably should have done that in WCW.
Well, actually, he did. It was called the Gold Club scandal. He really beat that ass, that's for sure. Did you not read about that? Did you not know about that? He said it in a deposition. He quote-unquote beat that ass.
That's a man that lives his life 83 weeks at a time.
I didn't realize we had such good Eric Bischoff jokes in the cylinder there. And we're coming in hot, too. Coming in real hot, just firing away.
We've traditionally been pretty nice to Eric.
I don't agree with everything he says, especially about the wrestling company that sends me a paycheck, especially today. But there's a lot of things that he's said and done that I really, really like and very intuitive. And maybe not HLA would be one of the things that I would put him at the forefront of being really cool with. But yeah, there's a lot of things that he did there.
Was that his fault? Was he writing at the time?
Let's blame it on him. I mean, he was the one that was like, yeah, this is a great idea. I mean, he never spoke up and said it was a bad idea.
Yeah, Vince is in the background like, Eric, I don't know. And then he's like, shut the fuck up. I know how to make money. Controversy creates cash.
Regardless, he's defended it over the years. So that he's at least, I mean, he can at least say, hey, I mean, it probably wasn't the best thing, you know, looking back at it, but it was a paycheck and we did it. And, you know, they're a bunch of horny boys that wanted to see it. So I guess that was our audience we were placating to. But yeah, in retrospect, it probably wasn't the best idea. That motherfucker hasn't said that. I mean, that's pretty easy. I fucking said it, no problem, and kind of glossed over while I did it. So, like, you don't even have to mean it, Eric. You can just say that, and people would be like, no, this was a great idea. It was brilliant. I love the writing team. We should have been doing more of it. That's pretty much how he stands on it.
On this Raw debut, Sean Stasiak and D'Lo Brown are having a match, and they don't do any, like, sick flips or nothing. So Rosie and Jamal come out and take them to Pound Town.
Why?
I don't know why I wrote it that way.
Dude.
Why?
I went back and rewatched this. Stasiak put D'Lo Brown into, I think it was an abdominal stretch, and Bischoff goes, what are you doing? That's not entertaining. And then you hear Jerry the King Lawler come over commentary and go, yeah, they're doing wrestling moves. There's nothing entertaining about that. And I'm like, I know Vince is just in the back with half a chub because he hates wrestling so much.
Oh, yeah. Like, all of that is just like, yes, you finally all understand me. We're producing the product I want. We have HLA. We have no semblance of wrestling. We have men who are vascular. We have Samoans beating the shit out of people. This is all I've ever wanted to produce. We're in the making movie business.
I don't know if we brought... I'm sure we brought this up on Umaga's episode. Greatest Samoan drop all time. Not even close.
Yep.
Like, number one by 1,000 miles.
Hands down.
So the next week on the 29th, they beat up Mae Young and Moolah, and they get a face pop for it, which I'm on board with.
Good.
Yeah, because everybody in the audience knew what her crimes were. That's why they fucking popped for it. She deserved it. That was justice. Justice! That's what happened.
August 5th, Lillian Garcia and The Fink are having a little roast battle over who should be ring announcer when Bischoff and then 3-minute warning show up. Howard pushes Lillian into them. Lillian gets Samoan dropped, which is fucking crazy to see, like, just visually. August 12th, they go after Minnie Goldust, who takes 2 insane bumps, including a top rope power slam. And then the next week, they have that week off, but Fozzy performs on Raw, in case you wanted to see Fozzy.
Quality, already love it. It's fantastic. And also, too, I'm pretty sure Minnie Goldust's rate, I hope, was doubled. For taking that amount of, hopefully that was doubled. Be like, hey, here's a little extra for you. This is a little bit extra we need from you. So here's a little bit extra for you.
They're back on the 26th when Jimmy Snuka is awarded some sort of plaque, I believe, for murder when 3-minute warning runs out.
He's great at it. He can do it and just slip right by. Like, just allegedly. He can just commit it and slip right by.
Oh, you guys need to quit being so mean. He had no idea what he was doing. He's not from this country. Quit being
he
so...
He barely speaks English.
Have this money in this briefcase.
September 2nd's victim is a young Jeff Hardy.
Hold on, you're going to say victim after we just mentioned Jimmy Snuka? Like, really? Like,
my bad.
He's going to glaze over that?
Speaking of problematic, then we get to some good old-fashioned WWE gay bashing. Wee! Wrestling. So September 9th, they beat up the lesbians who first strip to their undergarments. This is the whole hot lesbian action angle. The blonde one took the Samoan drop like right on her hip. Like that, she's probably not doing good right now, however many years later this is. That same week, SmackDown, Billy and Chuck were set to have their commitment ceremony. Do you guys want to unpack Billy and Chuck, or should we just ignore it for everyone's mental health?
I say we fast forward all the way to the wonderful year of 2023, where Anthony Bowen said in a wrestling ring, "Look, I'm not into your advances, Danny, because I'm gay," and people cheered, and yeah. One of the first people to clap was Billy Gunn. Why don't we just fast forward to that version of Billy Gunn? Extreme ally to the gay community. Can we just fast forward to that? Okay? To the point it doesn't even matter. To the point the people are clapping and not using the word gay as a derogatory term when wrestling is involved. So let's just fast forward right to that. Can we do that right now? Or are we still going to talk about Billy and Chuck?
I recommend we replace the word gay as a derogatory term with the words Chuck Palumbo.
For this, Bischoff is disguised as an old man acting as a wedding official. A 3-minute warning comes out and erupts. And this is going to lead to their first like actual feud in the company. So September 6th, Raw, Rico shows up, not only betraying Billy and Chuck as their manager, but also the SmackDown brand. He's going to get tossed in with Rosie and Jamal as like sometimes a manager, sometimes a third partner. Rico also beats Ric Flair on this Raw. It's like pretty clean. And he just beats Ric Flair.
Why not? Fuck it. Ric Flair probably ran up his credit card. To be really quite honest, like it was in the bar. Rico was like, "Can I get you a drink?" And he's like, "Sure." And then like he told the bartender, "Yeah, whatever he wants." And then Rick's like, "Yeah, just put my tab on that guy who said he's going to buy my drinks." And then all of a sudden Rico saw he had a $10,000 bill and told Triple H. And Triple H, "That isn't cool. We'll tell you what, Rick, you're jobbing to him clean." And Rick's like, "I don't care. I fucking lose them all. I'll fucking lose him again. I don't care, baby. I'll lose right on TV. I'll still be the fucking nature boy. I don't give a shit. But I'm paying that fucking bar tab. Fuck no. Fuck no. Fuck no. Woo."
All right, so later that night, a women's activist group confronts Eric Bischoff for all the women and gay beating that's been going on.
And the Gold Club stuff also, that got looped into there. They said it underneath their breath. Just let's not forget about that.
Stephanie McMahon is disguised. Okay, so Steph is like the GM of SmackDown, just to catch you up. She's disguised as one of the activists. She reveals herself by kicking Eric in the dick. Billy and Chuck run out to attack Bischoff, which brings in 3-minute warning, but they get caught by Billy and Chuck. And for the first time, they're beaten up since their debut because it's the go home to Unforgiven and we got to make it believable. At O2's Unforgiven, Rosie and Jamal finally make like an official real in-ring debut in a pretty short and sweet match. Looks like 3-minute warning is going to lose to the Famouser, but Rico interferes and Rosie tosses Billy to Jamal, who smashes him with a pop-up Samoan drop. That's it. From here, it's just a ton of house shows. They'd pop onto a Raw, usually getting the win, but you know, nothing too crazy. It's also around here, I think, that Rosie said that he jammed his femur bone into his hip socket.
Ugh.
I couldn't nail down exactly when that was, but I do believe jamming your femur bone into your hip socket is not good.
Nick, what were we talking about before the show started?
Oh, your hips hurting?
Oh, dude, because I was on a plane for too long. I can't imagine someone hurting their
fuck
hip.
Fuck off. I'm on a plane every fucking week. Get the fuck out of here. Would you fly to Alaska? Did you fly to the UK?
No, not at all. And that's what I'm saying. If I'm bothered from that, I can imagine what someone doing something athletic is going through when they actually have like force and it's
you're being so Chuck Palumbo, man.
And leave it to a Samoan just to have his femur jammed into his hip bone and be like, "Yeah, that's fine. I'll just keep going until I can't. It's an annoying thing. That's all right. I mean, you know."
So the guys are back on the premium live event stage for O2's Survivor Series to face the Dudleys in a table elimination match. And this is the night of the first ever Elimination Chamber, just important fact. Rosie and Jamal and Rico took on Bubba Ray, Spike Dudley, and Jeff Hardy to kick off the non-dark portion of the show. This is a super fun match. Spike takes the craziest face-first table bump I've ever fucking seen. Jeff is flying around like a nut because Prime Jeff is the best. Rosie is eliminated by Jeff via a swanton off the entranceway. This is Madison Square Garden, so if you know that entranceway. Yeah, 3 minutes tries to cheat by staying in the match, which draws out Devon to help his brother, 3D Rico, through a table for the win. Rosie got his first Royal Rumble experience in 03, and the Island Boys got into a feud with Kane and RVD at house shows, making it to TV a couple times with that match. And then by late May, early June-ish, things get a little weird for Rosie because Jamal got into a bar fight and was fired.
Samoan got in a bar fight. Shocking. I'm surprised we've gone, what now? Maybe 45 minutes and not mention a Samoan getting into a bar fight. We've talked about them shirking off sheer and utter pain, but we're now 45 minutes in and just now mentioning a bar fight by a Samoan.
Sounds like a setup to a hell of a joke. Samoan walks into a bar.
Everybody else walks out.
There you go. We got there. Rosie had more or less been a tag team wrestler with a family member his entire career at this point, and now all of a sudden he's alone in the biggest wrestling company in the world. So it gets a little rough for him. He starts taking losses on Heat and Raw to Val Venus, Goldust, Lance Cade, and for a second it looks like they also cut into his house show work, which could be good or bad depending on the deal you have.
I don't know what to do with you, pal. You don't have another Samoan with you. I don't know what to do unless there's two of you. The two of you I know what to do with. One of you, I have no idea. Three, I know all the things I can do. I can run an angle that lasts for 5 years with three of you. But one, I have no idea what to do with one of you.
Listen, you got two choices. Either you find someone to tag with or you get those big, juicy cheeks out like Rikishi.
His career takes a pretty drastic yet very memorable and fun turn when on July 7th, 03's Raw, Rosie faced the Hurricane. Before the match, Teddy Long and Rodney Mack of Thuggin' and Buggin' Enterprises come down to the ring to join Rosie. Fun fact, Rodney Mack is JYD's nephew. Hmm. So Thuggin' and Buggin' was a group that felt like they were victims of racism and were being held down by the Cracker. Of course, WWE is the correct vehicle to delicately tackle the finer points of systemic racism in this country. It was founded on Michael Hayes is in creative, for fuck's sake. But Thuggin' and Buggin' were, of course, hills.
I would say the Cracker. You mean the head Cracker. the Cracker of Crackerists.
So I believe Teddy he's attempting to recruit Rosie for his faction, but Hurricane is eventually caught in the 400-pound Samoan drop. And after the match, Teddy Long tries to get Rosie to like beat him up some more. He gets a little stern with the big man, so Rosie fucks up Teddy. Rodney Mack hops in to attack Rosie, and that's going to lead to a match between them, the next Raw, 7-14-03. So while the Samoan head is an impenetrable fortress, the head of their dick is not. So when Teddy low blows Rosie, Mac's about to score a cheap win. But then the hero we deserve but don't need right now, the Hurricane, comes to Rosie's aid and an alliance is formed.
This era of Hurricane is so fucking over. Dude. Like, I mean, this man has been living off this couple year run for decades, and rightfully so. It is cool as fuck. He's doing spots with The Rock. I think he's wrestling Ric Flair. I remember going to a Raw in Moline, Illinois, like around this time where like the Hurricane is just the most over fucking thing ever. Being mad that his t-shirts weren't at the merch stand, but I didn't fucking tweet about it saying that WWE merch is shit. I just, you know, bought it online like the rest of the fucking world. But, you know, I didn't have Twitter at that time to complain about shit like that. And then all of a sudden WWE take notice and feel like their merch department is fucking up because some fucking 27-year-old on Twitter made a complaint about their merchandise. But regardless, Hurricane, super fucking over, with tons of fucking signs in the crowd. Like, if you're Rosie and you're like, man, they took me to fucking house shows. I don't know what the fuck's going to happen. I don't know where to go. And all of a sudden, fucking Hurricane puts his big fucking over cape and puts it around your fucking shoulder and be like, get on my back and let's ride this motherfucker all the way to your residual check. Let's go.
It's such a bummer that this only lasted, that era of Hurricane lasted, what, 2 years? Something like that? If this was around today, he'd be golden. This would be a decade-long character, but because of the time, it's pissed away for no reason, really. It's cut down at its height. It was wasted.
Look, like, and I know probably Hurricane wanted to like have serious matches and be the serious wrestler, and like everybody wants to feel that way. But you know what? I really like dressing like the Man Scout, and it's a really fun character to do. And there's different things you could do. It's a lot of fucking fun. You just got to figure out how to have fun in it. And if you're Rosie, you're like, this is a lifeline. And they at one point in time, they put you with Stacy Keibler too. Mm-hmm. So it's like, now you're this big overall package where you have the girl. And then also too, like I overheard a conversation at TV. I won't say who the people were having the conversation, but it was like one of the factions we have on television. And one of the guys was talking to another guy, and one of the guys who was in this faction was like, man, they want to put this girl with us. I don't think that's the best thing for what we're trying to go for. And the other guy was like, how stupid are you? Like, you want the girl in your group because, like, now if she's booked, you guys got to be booked. And you're at least going to walk out on TV with her. That's more TV time. And also, too, there's other things you can do with her. She can get in feud with another girl, and then you're getting in feud with another faction, and this faction has a girl. Like, you want the girl in your group because it rounds out your fucking group. So you should be pushing for this girl to be in your group, not being like, well, I don't know if we need a girl in a group because it makes it less cool. And you're going to get her action because you have this very attractive woman and she's doing her own thing, and it's bringing attention to your overall package over here. And you know, the matches they had were really good. Hurricane is really smart, and he's actually, you know, I think a very underrated tag team wrestler. He was part of the Serial Thrillers back in the day. Him and Mike Maverick, who was one of the Dups, like they had some really great matches. And Hurricane's got a really good mind, I think, for tag team wrestling, especially when he's the smaller guy, and then he has a bigger guy, and then when you're doing character stuff, like, he's great, man. He's real good.
How dare you gloss over a three count?
Well, we all know Evan Courageous was the real mastermind behind that. I mean, Hurricane was like, he was a part of the secret sauce, but he wasn't the burger. We all know where the meat was. That's Evan Courageous.
You brought up the Stacy Keibler thing. I don't want to go too out of order, but I do just want to give you guys a quick little quote from the most masterful linguist that the WWE commentary team has ever had, Jerry the King Lawler. During
oh, God.
The whole, absolutely, Nick.
Oh, yes. Let's get into Jerry the King Lawler quotes from 2004, ladies and gentlemen. Let's do that. You think googly eyes is problematic? Oh, no. Oh, let's see what Jerry has to say from 2004. Continue, Tyler.
So they have, it's one of the ones where Stacy comes out with Rosie and Hurricane, and she's in this mask, looks like a Batgirl mask, and King's like, well, I don't even know if that is Stacy. And they cut to a shot from her behind, and she's got like these very small shorts on. He goes, oh, I think that's her.
What a pervert.
Not even what the best pervert. Part. Not even the best part, because you know it's not done until Jerry Lawler drops a one-liner. And he goes, mm-hmm. She's got more legs. Actually, I want to see if you guys can fill in the blank here. She's got more legs than what?
A spider?
She... Good guess. She's got more legs than a bucket of KFC fried chicken. And she's about as finger licking good.
Oh, he made it dirtier. He made it dirtier. I love it. That pervert. Like, God, there were so many times he would have his phone in his hand, and then he would call me over in the locker and be like, take a look at this. And it would just be this blonde with no pants on. I don't know why, but he's such a pervert, like oversexed. I don't know what testosterone boosters he's taking, but I want at least a handful of them. That'll last me at least 3 months.
I haven't seen this much clam since I went fishing.
All right, Jesus. So from here, Rosie joined forces with the Hurricane as a superhero in training. Shit, for short.
Shit! Superhero in training! It spells shit! That's what makes it funny! Because it's shit! That's hysterical! I want shirts that say shit! I love it! I love it! This is peak quality television. I don't know why we are not nominated for an Emmy every year. Oh, because we're not union? Oh, well, that ain't fucking happening. I'll go without an Emmy, but we definitely should be winning it every year.
As a 10-year-old watching this and seeing the superhero in training on his shirt, I remember going, superhero. Oh, they got it on television. They had a workaround. Did you guys see the clip of when Hurricane is first pitching the superhero in training idea to Rosie and Goldust is backstage?
Oh, yeah.
That's solid.
Well, and also too, like he had the little like, janky looking like blank man looking costume.
Blank man's a deep pool.
I mean, there are very few people that would get that reference, and only two people on this podcast will. A third is fucking clueless right now.
I'm happy to be here.
But then like they had the evolution into the good costume, which I know was on our timeline, but that was such a minor detail. That they spent a couple of weeks with like him in this blank man looking outfit and then get into the good costume. Like just even taking that little journey and that little part of the story, you won't see today. He'll just come out with like, he's like, oh, you're a superhero and now you have this awesome costume. But just even that one little beat of him being in training and now you're not in training and here's your actual costume. And you're like, oh, he has an actual costume. And then you have some sort of like emotions with that. Like, that's great. Just that little beat of taking a little extra time and putting just a little thing and having him come out with his new gear mean that much more. Like, that's great. I love that.
Rosie's first thoughts on the gimmick, both in kayfabe and reality, were, oh boy, how am I going to make this work? It was just so crazy different from what he'd done, you know, but at the end of the day, he's a pro. He crushed it. I thought it was cool because all he had been to this point was this huffy, puffy, you know, bruising badass. And this showed like a sillier, funnier side to him. And if you listen to him talk in any interview, that's like who he was. Like, I'm sure he'd fuck your shit up if he had to. But in general, he just seemed like a jolly dude.
Yeah, he seems like the guy that you would get a big hug from. He'd get a big smile. But like the second, like all of a sudden, like at the other end of the bar, somebody was getting loud and shit like that. He'd be like, hold on a second, go over. Punch that guy's fucking jaw off his face and then go back to having a wonderful conversation with you and laughing with you. That to me seems like the type of guy he was.
And I have a bone to pick with Vince McMahon from this time, specifically about the lack of Rosie and Hurricane action figures. That is a very poor oversight on Vince McMahon's part, because Rosie in this outfit had one action figure release, and I think Hurricane only had a handful. I don't know why Vince didn't print money, just release it, having them change up their gear ever so slightly, have them reverse colors, do all sorts of fun stuff. Because as a kid at this time, I would have bought the shit out of those.
Yeah,
it would have been only that one Ruthless Aggression, maybe 11, yep. 9. We had boxes of them at High Spots, and that was pre-taking advantage of getting figures signed. Era, like if we only knew, we would have had it signed and in a red paint pen because it would have matched beautifully. Mm-hmm.
So Rosie would show up in a makeshift superhero costume on August 4th Raw to save Hurricane from a post-match beating by Christian. They did a lot of tagging together, but nothing too nuts. No huge feud or featured spot, but it's just a fun, cool tag team to break up the serious kick pads matches. This team also really highlighted how good of a hot tag guy Rosie was. He was a monster, but he was like still fast enough and agile enough to like clear out the ring in a very exciting way. And then he could fall back on his big ass power moves. They'd wrap up 03 at December's Armageddon in a tag team gauntlet match for the titles. They knocked off La Resistance, but Mark Jindrak and Lance Cade would sneak up on Hurricane to eliminate them. Flair and Batista won, so that's fun. July 19th, 04's episode of Raw, Rosie appeared with his new orange, fancier costume, seemingly graduated to full superhero. So from here, Hurricane and Rosie started hitting the tag circuit on both TV and house shows. Rosie would break away from time to time to work like a heat solo, winning and losing against people like Stevie Richards, Rodney Mack, and a little baby, Randy Orton. Around March and April of 05, it looked like Rosie's schedule got like way, way lighter. I'm not sure if it was an injury, like his hip and knee, but he'd be back super strong May 1st, 2005 for Backlash, where Rosie and Hurricane defeated La Resistance and won the tag team titles. So big moment for Rosie, knowing who his parents are, to win the WWF titles. The first big feud they get into as champs was with the Heartthrobs facing them at house shows on Heats and on Raw. It never got any big match as they pivoted to Lance Cade and Trevor Murdoch and lost the titles to them at 05's Unforgiven.
I've watched one of the Heartthrob Rosie and Hurricane matches. Holy shit. Do you know what their gimmick?
Holy shit good or holy shit bad?
Holy shit bad. Do you know what their gimmick was? They waved their dicks. Like it was like the dicks, but not as bad. I don't even know how that's possible.
I remember watching Raw religiously every week, and like you gotta keep in mind it also too with this time of Raw, like every match just felt like a banger. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the storylines were goofy, but when a lot of these wrestlers came out and wrestled, matches were fantastic, and you just let wrestlers wrestle, and you were watching Eddie Guerrero wrestle on TV against John Cena. I mean, like, wrestling was so good. And I remember thinking during a match with William Regal and Tajiri taking on the Heartthrobs, and I was like, oh my God, this is the first bad match I've ever seen on Raw. This is like the first match I've ever seen that I don't like. On wrestling, I'm a fan and I love everything, but I hate this and this is not good. I do not like this. It was at that moment I became one of those people that are like, this isn't a good match because of this and this and this. Where before I just consumed everything and loved it. It was that match with the Heartthrobs taking on William Regal and Tajiri that made me go, oh no, not every match is good and some of them are kind of shit, especially ones on TV. And then it just felt like from there, you'd see a bad match every once in a while. It was like that was the moment where all of a sudden, like, the cracks in the dam started to happen. And you started seeing Heidenreich going out there fucking up spots. And then all of a sudden, you'd see other people fucking up matches. Then other people come up from development that suck. And then all of a sudden, they've got the tough enough kids wrestling. And some of them aren't really ready for that. And you're like, oh, this is not good. This is bad. And it was actually the Heartthrobs, and I hate it because I actually know both of those guys and they've always been super nice to me and I've shared a locker room with them, but I just look at them and like you were the thing that made me realize that there are bad matches in this world.
That's so mean. So
I think the match that you saw with them versus Tajiri and William Regal, I think got them a number one contendership shot at Rosie and Hurricane. I binged a lot of this stuff, and that match stood out. It was the same one that Stacy Keibler was in, because they came out, they were... How would you describe the gimmick, Jake? I'm having a hard time kind of figuring it out, because the dicks were the Chippendale dancers. How would you describe the Heartthrobs?
I mean, the Salvatore Sentier, but with more dick thrusting, I guess. Like, better abs. Salvatore Sentier with better abs. That's because they had the weird-looking hats and shit like that. But yeah, I remember where I was standing when I saw that match. I was at
fucking 9/11.
It was like, and it was right during college too. And I know exactly where I was when it fucking happened. Like it was in my room when I was rooming with this girl at work, Amy. And I was in my room because I'd recorded Raw because I don't remember what I was doing the night before. I think I was wrestling at the time too. So I might have had wrestling training that Monday night. So I recorded Raw because I really want to see it. And then I saw it and I was standing like kind of in my closet because I was kind of doing something. And that match came on. Like I remember exactly where I was fucking standing. And I just remember standing like at the foot of my bed looking at the TV and like, what the fuck is this?
Jim Cornette can retire now because we pinpointed the exact moment wrestling died. The Heartthrobs, apparently.
Yeah, for me, that's what it was for me. That was the end.
Jake, I was 2 years into watching wrestling as a child when this came on.
Oh, I'm sorry. You missed out on all the great fucking wrestling.
Thank you. I appreciate
that. There was great matches after great matches on Raw, and it was in that moment that I'm like, oh, they put bad matches on Raw?
Dude, no, I grew up in a time where it's like, oh shit, there was a good match on Raw this week.
I know the exact moment where that happened, where it all fucking turned. It was right there.
So in this 05 Unforgiven match, not only do Rosie and Hurricane lose the belts, but Hurricane suffers a kayfabe neck stinger. And this would cause a series of losses due to his injury. October 17th, 05's Raw, Hurricane was beat up by Kurt Angle at the request of Vince after Hurricane confronted him about Vince firing JR by saying, what's up with that? what they didn't show on TV, but they showed on WWE.com, was that Rosie had come down to help Hurricane, albeit way too late, and Hurricane kind of ripped his mask off, slapped Rosie. So here's the crack in the dam as far as their relationship. Following week, Hurricane did not show up for a World Tag Team title match, leaving Rosie to face champions Murdoch and Cade alone. During the match, he pops in out of costume, the top of the ramp now going by Gregory Helms, as he watched Rosie get double-teamed and defeated.
Just pissed it away.
It was going great. I mean, wrestling's already falling apart because of heartthrobs, but I was going to ruin this too.
And Gregory Helms, I remember when this turn happened, he had the look of a piece of shit. I think he pulled that off really well with like the glasses and the long leather coat. But I think he would have been so much better off staying as a babyface and able to show off some of his wackiness, like the stuff that he came up with. The Hurricane, that was his, and he owned it, and he did a great job with it. And I think they switched him over to that, and then they're like, "What? Why are you not printing money still?" And then goes on to Cruiserweight, and it's gone, and it was a waste because it took something that both men could have used for a long time. They could have been in this tag team. They could have made a lot of money, sold a lot of merch. Nope. It lasted, what, a year and a half, if that?
On November 7th, 05, Raw, Helms beat Rosie for the first time since they started teaming together. It was also around this time that Jamal was rehired by WWE, and he and Rosie were scheduled to reunite as 3-Minute Warning, even having a dark match together January 9th, 06 on Heat against Bison Bravado and Trent Acid. Trent Acid popping up in WWE. After that, they caught a couple Heartland spots, including a loss to heavyweight champion Jon Moxley very early in his career.
Probably still weird as shit, just fucking roaming around, getting all fucking twitchy and shit. Bet he was just as much of a feral cat as he is today.
So apparently they pitched Jamal and Rosie as the Shield here, which would be at least the second time they almost made someone the Shield. They wanted them to get the riot gear, the military boots, you know, just be the Shield.
They fucking have wanted to do a paramilitary group fucking for years. Fucking years. I think I even said it one time that they almost had like Otto Wands, Murray Happer, Bulby Cannon, and Bossman and Steve Bradley too, because they always knew they needed a smaller guy to take all the fucking bumps, and they almost did it there too. But they have wanted a fucking paramilitary group that comes in with flap jackets, and they wanted their own like Black Forest Ops before there was Black Forest Ops.
So in the end, instead of the Shield, they ended up wanting Jamal to be Umaga. And without plans for Rosie, he was released from his WWE contract March 21st, 06, without the second run of 3-Minute Warning ever making it to TV.
That's a cool little through line that his brother ended up being a part of that paramilitary group, the Shield, that they did end up doing.
What? That's the sound of a rattlesnake in your earbuds. That's right, if you didn't want the stone-cold Steve Austin experience, you need to shut them earbuds off right now. As a matter of fact, why don't you just take them ears and rip them off? Because if you don't want stone-cold talking to you, then you don't deserve ears. Can I get a hell yeah? I'm going to go ahead and assume you said it. I'm here today because I want to tell you about my friends over at 10 Bell Pod. 10 Bell Pod. Tyler Wood, Nick Alexander, and Jake, the Man Scout Man, and bringing you some of the best wrestling content on the internet. Now can I get a hell yeah? While you're giving me a hell yeah, why don't you go ahead and pop over to their Patreon, go ahead and give a subscription, and why don't you hop your fat little ass right over to Pro Wrestling Tees and get a 10 Bell Pod exclusive t-shirt featuring all three of these beautiful men. Might be saying, what? What? Stone Cold, you think these men are beautiful? God damn it, I do. Now you get over there and you buy that t-shirt before I stomp a mud hole in you and walk it dry. Now let me get a hell yeah.
From here, it was off to All Japan, where Matt did a slight rename to Ro-Z. It looked like the first match was June 25th, 06, beating Satoshi Kojima. He joined All Japan's R.O.N.D. stable, roughly Obsessed and Destroy. So 06, this is obviously after the Misawa exodus. I think New Japan is like coming in strong right now. What was this era of All Japan like?
This All Japan era was weird, But he was still relevant enough because this is when Muta came over and like won the Triple Crown. Also, too, isn't like this the stable also include like D'Lo Brown?
Yes.
And I think even Bulby Cannon.
Yeah.
As well, too.
Takamichinoku.
Like, yeah, like it was a pretty fucking cool ass stable. I mean, D'Lo in All Japan at this time, holy shit, D'Lo is really fucking good. You know, people talk a lot about his Intercontinental run. No, you guys got to look back at D'Lo in All Japan in 06 here. He was unfucking believable. He was so fucking good. And like I said, he was wrestling legends like Muta, maybe even like Kawada, because I think Kawada was still around out of loyalty. But like Muta had kind of come in and realized that the exit is kind of like fuck business over and probably is like a kind of a way to help. Muta came in and they had some good pieces there, but this was kind of like the death throes of All Japan. It was kind of like the last time it was really good and relevant and people wanted to see their shows. I mean, now they still exist, but it's obviously not what it used to be. But there was some really cool shit, most notably what Rosie and D'Lo were doing at the time.
Back over in America in 07, he hit the indie circuit, and he did this like weird sporadic stretch with WWE and developmental without actually being signed back to an official contract. He wrestled a dark match under his real name August 20th, 07 on Raw, laying down for Johnny Jeter. The following day, August 21st, for a SmackDown taping, also lost to Jeter. He made some OVW appearances. September 7th, he wrestled a bunch of tag matches with Ava Jr. as the Sons of Samoa, which is kind of a cool name. Also in 2007, Matt was a contestant on ABC's reality show, Fat March.
But it really got his name kind of circulating around, and I...
This did?
Yeah, this
oh,
did.
Oh, nice, okay.
Yeah, like, I remember this was kind of a thing, and I remember, I don't know if I've discussed it on here before, have I told you guys about the time I almost tagged with the Italian Stallion?
He took you down for a show, and like...
Yes,
yeah,
he took me down for a show, yes. Well, while we were sitting in the crowd waiting for anybody to acknowledge us or whatever to fucking happen, or just hang out like what we were doing, the person we hung out with was Rosie.
Oh, shit.
So people would come over and say hi to Stallion, and they'd be like, Rosie, how you doing? I heard you know, lost all this weight, and everybody was real cool with him. He was cool, like, he was cool with me. Like, he kind of recognized I was in a weird spot, and he was nice to me, you know, because, like, you want to stay out of the way of all the contracted people, because this is a WWE locker room, not an AEW locker room, where everybody's cool. Everybody's walking on eggshells at this time in WWE, so, you know, it's supposed to
be. He who shall not be named.
So everything's fucking uptight and security's everywhere and people are drug tested and they're not getting what they need to fucking be happy. Like, it's fucking shitty and you just want to stay out of his way and you don't want to get yelled at. And, like, I just remember sitting there with Stallion and Rosie all day, and Rosie just being cool as shit. Biggest, brightest smile you ever see, and Rosie was there hoping to get a spot that day, and, you know, was sitting in right with us, hoping somebody would come over, like, hey, you two, or you, come here, you know? Like, I don't know if he wrestled that night in Columbia or not, but he was there the whole time. He was a cool dude and kind of made me feel comfortable when I was being super uncomfortable, so I always really appreciated that about him.
From here, Matt did sporadic indie spots and eventually started helping his dad run, book, promote, etc. Epic Championship Wrestling out of Florida. But unfortunately, it was like around this time his health really started breaking down. January 14th, Matt was hospitalized with congestive heart failure, which had been diagnosed a little earlier. He also had arterial fibrillation, which meant the top chamber of his heart beat differently from the bottom chamber, and that really kept him from getting back into wrestling. He really struggled with his weight because he had a chronic knee injury, had that hip issue, so it was like this horrible cycle of, you know, he can't really get back in shape because he's in so much pain, and then that pain is causing him to, you know, keep gaining weight. This would basically force him to retire, aside from a couple matches here or there, with his last tagging with Hurricane and Vinny Pacifico beating Chris Benet, Jay George, Steve Scott at a World Wrestling Show in New York, July 9th, 2016.
Actually, I know two of those people they just mentioned. Vinny, I've definitely seen Vinny around quite a bit. And Steve Scott, I've also seen on a couple of shows. Actually, Steve Scott, if I'm not mistaken, did the Sunset Flip buckle bomb that I took from him. So I think he's getting his body in shape, and he's been wrestling a little bit more, so good for him. But it's really weird when you are somebody's like last match like that. Like I was like the last person to do anything in wrestling with like Skandar Akbar. Like that's like a weird thing. Like, oh, this is this person's last match, and like this is the thing they were known for, and I was the other guy. I mean, it's, I don't know. It's kind of a weird feeling. Like you don't want to be that footnote and known for that. And if the person was really nice to you, it's very like makes you appreciate life a little bit more. Cause you're like, whoa, because I know it was with Skandar Akbar. Like, and I think like a few days later he'd passed. I'm like, Jesus. Like, and also too, I think Kamala was in that match and he was like, I was the last person he wrestled or second to last or one of the last. So, and it's really weird. It's an unsettling feeling, and I really kind of don't want that too much anymore. So I feel bad for everybody involved in that whole match.
So then, sadly, Matt Anoa'i passed away April 17, 2017, 10 days after his 47th birthday in Pensacola due to complications related to congestive heart failure. Final thoughts on Rosie.
I'm happy I got to go back down this little memory lane of all the fun I had watching Hurricane and Rosie when I was a kid. It's sad that he didn't get really any solo run at all or a chance to showcase what he was like as a singles wrestler. But I think he was pretty happy with the way his run with Hurricane went there. And I think it's a bright spot on his career and his life. And I got to tell you, as a kid watching, it was a bright spot on Raw at that time for sure. So sad Rosie didn't get another shot to make things work in wrestling.
Super cool life. He seemed like a nice person. He had a very successful career as a tag team wrestler, which is super cool knowing who his dad is. The Hurricane stuff was fun and silly. It showed how versatile he could be. It sucks that he didn't get to see Roman come out of the other end of the booze, because I know he got interviewed a lot about how much everyone hated Roman up front. But now, you know, Roman's like the cool heel. But Rosie just had to sit there and like swallow people rage screaming at Roman. Then I think he'd be really happy to see like what the bloodline angle has turned into. A lot of super cool stuff. But yeah, Matt's another strong branch of the Anoa'i family. You have Japan, ECW, WWE, winning belts all over the planet. But way too young to leave anything behind. But what he did leave is, you know, it's pretty cool.
This is one of those episodes where you're like, you know, I really enjoyed this guy's work. And I haven't like thought about that, you know, because it's always been, oh, this guy did this, and then, oh, this guy, and this, you know, like, this podcast is really wonderful in the sense that we take the time to go through a lot of stuff that I just kind of went through because it was the thing on TV, it was the thing that I was studying, a match that I watch, or I was aware that this guy was over here, or this was going on, just because I was paying attention to wrestling. But, you know, I feel like in some aspects, even though I work in wrestling, I'm very much removed from wrestling in some parts of it, especially my fandom I'm very removed from. So when I dip back into my fandom and remember stuff that I watched on TV and enjoyed and matches that I enjoyed and even interactions with, you know, the people we discuss, it fully forms in my mind like, oh, yeah, I really enjoyed this guy's work. I really was very entertained and happy that I got to see him wrestle, and I'm happy for him that he got those opportunities to do that. And, you know, I'm very appreciative of his work, and I guarantee there are a lot of people, if they sat down and took the time to hopefully listen to this episode or do some of the reflecting that I do when recording these episodes, you'll realize it too, that, you know what, Rosie had a good career. He had some good matches, and he brought a lot of joy, and he delivered. And I think at the end of the day, as a performer, that's what you hope that everybody says about you in the end, is that you delivered upon your performances every time you went out there. And Rosie most certainly is that. And he, as I said before, he's probably a guy that would give you a big smile and a hug with maybe a dip in his mouth. And then somebody loud at the end of the bar is shooting his mouth off, and he would go over there and punch his teeth down through his lower intestine and then come back and give you another big hug and shoot the shit with you. So that's who he was. And yeah, he'll be missed. And it's sad he didn't get to see where his family sits today, and maybe he would have been a part of that if he was around.
That is Rosie's 10 Bell Pod. Thank you for listening. Thanks to everyone donating to the Patreon. Check out our Pro Wrestling Tees store. We got one of those now. That feels neat. It feels like a big, cool thing.
It almost feels like I work for AEW now.
Jake, Tyler, you have anything before we leave this episode?
Yeah, if you
leave a fuck you, Tyler. fuck you. Real AEW employees go first. How about that? Just because you tweet bad shit about AEW merch doesn't make you an employee, okay? Make sure you leave a review. That's very important. Whatever platform you are listening to this is very important. You leave a review. As Nick said, we have a Pro Wrestling Tees store, and boy, does it make me happy when they have to print my shirts, and boy, does it make me even happier that there is another store that has a t-shirt with my image on it, and someone in Pro Wrestling Tees has to print my face on a t-shirt. It makes me really happy. It makes me feel like a very big celebrity when I walk in there, and especially when I walk in, I'm like, oh, you're printing one of my shirts right here. I'm the guy that's on that t-shirt right there. So make sure you do that sometime around November in around Thanksgiving so I could do that then the next time I'm in Pro Wrestling Tees.
Yeah, please check out that Pro Wrestling Tees site and be sure to message or tweet at or tag Jake whenever you buy it, and make sure to tag me too because it'll piss Jake off. And other than that, if you guys want to tell us anything you'd be interested in as far as Patreon episodes go, I think we're going to be shooting one of those here in just a little bit. But yeah, anything you guys want to hear us talk about, if you like the show and tell, if you want to hear some more top fives, if you want more pro wrestling drunk history, let us know. And thanks for checking out the podcast, and we'll catch you later.
All right. Fuck. Yeah. Well, next week. Goodbye.
I haven't seen this much clam since I went fishing. Oh.